we get the hour underway by welcoming in, as we do each week, our friend writer Colin Fleming. Hello, Colin.
What's up, fellas?
How about those Boston Bruins last night taking care of business?
How about those complainers on the social media who don't know what a body check is? You're just lowering your shoulder, cocking it, powering into the man, and separating him from the puck. And I thought that was a thing of very legal beauty last night.
Well, and it was only 2 minutes, so I got to think that it might be the end of it right there.
I don't know about that. I feel like they get a little retroactive-y with this, right? Where they're like, okay, that was penalty, just a minor, and then people complain, and they get overwhelmed with the querulousness of everybody, and they think, oh, we better do a social justice move. But you are taught when you play hockey in peewees on up, because that's when you can start nailing people to try to make them swallow their tongue, which is a great, beautiful thing, I think. When you enter the offensive zone especially, if you don't want to get drilled, right, keep your head up. If you watch that play, as soon as he's outside the blue line, he's looking at his skate. And it cost Eric Lindros the bulk of his, he still made the Hall of Fame, but the bulk of his career when Scott Stevens would repeatedly lay him out. If you don't want to get popped, you don't want to go to the hospital, keep your head up. Otherwise, this isn't really victim blaming. You have no one else to blame. Because McAvoy did the exact right thing that you're supposed to do, and the refs erred against him in giving him that penalty. I really enjoyed it. I didn't enjoy reading all of the people saying, though, on social media that McAvoy's family should die and everything, but okay, that's a different issue.
Yeah, well, that's social media, and we've discussed that already. But today, to better things, and that's going back in time 75 years, which was an especially fruitful year for films, and we're going to talk about some of them today, including one of my all-time favorites. It's my favorite film noir of all time. I love, love, love Double Indemnity.
It's funny how we transitioned to that, and you made it sound like we were going to venture into rosier territory, right?
Yeah.
Double Indemnity, like, it's so much darker than what I'm even talking about there on social media after a hockey game, and I think it's particularly dark, and I would imagine you feel the same way, because of Fred McMurray. He is someone that we think is cast against type in this film, yet Fred McMurray was very good at playing absolutely odious people, right? Until one of his kids was saying, Daddy, I don't want to see you like that anymore. This is disturbing. And he sort of mended his ways. But remember the film The Apartment?
Yes.
Where he's like this sleazy womanizer with no regard for anyone's feelings. Like, he just destroys lives and souls, and it doesn't really seem to impact his soul because he doesn't have one in that film. And in this particular film noir, which is really one of the two benchmark noirs, I think it's this film and Out of the Past, more than any other films in this particular weird American, could only be endemic to America, subgenre. These are your two sort of go-to films. And Out of the Past is that film because, you know, the flashbacks within the flashbacks, and you have the lighting so dark that the actors joke that the set was lit by matches. In Double Indemnity, it's more straightforward pictorially, but there is that moment in it, and you need one of these in a classic film noir where the protagonist, the anti-hero, is going to make a decision that is going to change and usually end their life. And we talk about the heart wants what the heart wants. Sometimes in film noir, the groin wants what the groin wants. And that's what happens with Fred McMurray, who's dealing with Barbara Stanwyck, who is also cast against type in a certain way. She was a great comedian, great funny actress, very talented, tended to do frothier roles. And then you have Edward G. Robinson as this bulldog, like he would be in Orson Welles' The Stranger, ferreting out this insurance scam, basically, that these two are trying to run after they've murdered somebody.
And, but he's great, too, and a little bit against type, because deep down he turns out to be a real softy here in this role.
He's a softy in the sense that he's not going to be parted from doing his job, but he is a Tolstoyan, I would say, insurance fraud investigator, because you can want to absolutely nail somebody and know how guilty they are, and still retain, I know we're not supposed to think this way, but it's called human nature, a degree of affection for them. He has a degree of affection for Fred McMurray, even though he finds out what McMurray did. And they're kind of playing upon the classic trope that you get in Crime and Punishment, where you have the police inspector and you have Raskolnikov. And the police inspector is very much that Robinson type of character, where a relationship develops weirdly, creepily between the two of them. And I think that is what is so disturbing about this film, because we are often not just one side of a given thing within that quadrant of human nature. We'll be in this portion, that portion simultaneously. And this noir does an excellent job, I think, of depicting that kind of multi-dimensionality of how we are.
I love the structure of the film, too, which to me is very reminiscent of Sunset Boulevard, in that the narrator is, no longer with us.
That was another kind of noir idea. You see that with DOA, right? That Arrival.
Mm.
Sunset Boulevard is, to me, one of those just too much emphasis on that setup notion. Sometimes we've talked about how I find that a number of Twilight Zone episodes don't work because of that. And you have the episode of the Twilight Zone that's clearly half-inched from Sunset Boulevard. I like just the way that Double Indemnity unfurls, because you have this plan that seems like it can't go right. And there are just so many little touches, like the lighting of the cigarettes, right? And the way at the end, that reversal of who lights whose cigarette is
right.
Flipped. And there's just a structure to it that's very wide open and expansive. And yet within the picture itself, it's also hermetically sealed. So it's operating upon this like axis of paradox, but we completely buy in. We're completely within the sway of this particular film.
We're talking with Colin Fleming here on Downtown. Another great film from that year, one that has stood the test of time, certainly is Gaslight.
Gaslight's a film that I think it's almost directed against type, because you have George Cukor, who you would associate more with a screwball comedy than this kind of liminal world that this picture exists in. It's a melodrama. It has Victorian trappings. It's not film noir, because film noirs were not costume pictures, right? Film noirs were gritty American kind of things. And this has a cosmopolitan European sensibility to it. And it was a popular play. It's been made into films a number of times. But I think what really makes it work is Joseph Cotten. Joseph Cotten is the rescuer as such within this film. And you never really knew with Joseph Cotten, I think that's probably why Orson Welles liked him so much, if he was going to be a good guy or a bad guy, until like you're kind of far into the film. And he was that way with Hitchcock. He's like this avuncular presence that you think, okay, I like this guy, he's my uncle. Yet maybe he goes a little bit too far with things. What's his motive? What's he up to here? But it's really, if you are someone who frequently encounters, I guess as we all do now, the word gaslight, you can come here for one-stop illustration on what it actually means to gaslight somebody. And it very rarely means what you see it pressed into service as currently in the news cycle. Because what is happening here is Charles Boyer's very dogged attempt to make Ingrid Bergman lose her mind. And I think Ingrid Bergman is an actress that oftentimes leaves me at room temperature. I don't really rise or fall that much with her, but I think that works in this particular picture. She's almost like this substrate upon which this criminal activity is going to be carried out. And she's good at that here, and thankfully, though, we have Joe Cotten to help her out.
Love Joseph Cotten. Also love Ray Milland in a stretch of movies. He did some dogs through the years, but he had a pretty good stretch there in the mid-40s, including one of the creepiest horror movies ever, I think. I love The Uninvited.
Yes, you had mentioned that the two we just discussed were in your top five or so. The Uninvited is in my top 10. It is, for me, the best straight-up, unless we're counting Scrooge from 1951, but that has some other things going on, but the best straight-up ghost story picture that we have, where we are in the house and it is haunted, and it's not gimmicky, it's not hokey, it is eminently believable, and it is as atmospheric as movie making can be. And I like the setup here, because you have this Ray Milland character, and he's buying this house on this wind-lashed cliff type of deal with his sister. And it's kind of like a Roderick Usher sort of vibe going on with that. Like, why are you buying this house with your sister, dude? Like, that's, what are you two up to here exactly? You know what I mean? So not like they're up to anything, but it still just kind of gives the picture this little modulation, this little wrinkle right off the bat. But it also makes you like these people, because you think maybe they're just close and they're cool with that. And I wish I was closer with my sister. You start to think that way type of thing, and you like them because they're living their lives and they're trying to be happy. And they fall in love with this house, although their little dog hates it right away. So people out there, if you're buying a home, bring along your little terrier with you.
Yes.
See how he or she feels about it, because if they don't want to cross the threshold, you probably have some bad hoodoo there and you would move on. But you also have the jazz standard Stella by Starlight
right.
in this film. And there is this olfactory theme, this smell theme. And it's funny, because when I watch this picture, I almost feel like I can pick up on that
parochial
quality, right? Like,
right.
smelling you, TV screen? It's just, it's that haunting that it seems to waft from that planar field into that space where you sit watching this. And it's just, there's no blood. It's completely gore-free, but it is absolutely terrifying in a delicious way.
No question about it. Now, one, I'm embarrassed to say I haven't seen The Scarlet Claw.
Oh, I wasn't going to guess that one. Yeah, okay, The Scarlet Claw. So you've seen some of the, I'm sure, how could you not, because they're on all the time too, the Basil Rathbone and Nigel Bruce.
Oh, yeah, and I love many of them, but somehow I've missed this one.
This one is the seventh or eighth picture in the series, and people think that Sherlock, the BBC series, was so radical because it dislocated these characters from their Victorian and Edwardian times. Well, that's really what was happening from the get-go with this classic run of 12 films that this duo did. It was during World War II. It was in real time. So you have, like, Sherlock Holmes taking on Nazis. So what they do in this particular film, and it's the only Sherlock Holmes film outside of various adaptations of Hound of the Baskervilles. It's a horror film. Nigel Bruce and Sir Watson and Sherlock, they go to Canada for a convention on the occult, which is, like, completely against type, because, like, the Sussex Vampire, that story, Holmes wants nothing to do. He doesn't believe in the supernatural. But here he's like, you know what, Watson, you've been making some good points as we drink the port. I will go with you to Canada. And so Canada basically becomes like the Scottish Moors, except we're in Canada, somewhere in like outside of Toronto. And it's all of that German expressionist, natural, moor setting, swamp, peat underfoot, and some guy with basically hands that are kind of like garden spades who is ripping people's throats out. So you have a bit of a nod to the Hound back in Hound of the Baskerville. And again, it's just pure atmosphere. It doesn't really matter. This is the great trick, really, of all of the Conan Doyle-related works. It doesn't matter who done it, because you are there for the relationship between these two men, and you are there for the atmosphere. And as atmosphere, it's pretty untoppable.
And then Laura, oh man, you couldn't put together a better dream cast than this one, with Gene Tierney and Dana Andrews and even a little Vincent Price thrown in.
Definitely. Gene Tierney is, I will flat out tell you that I am in love with her. If her ghost comes to me tonight, I'm going to say, like, look, is there any way you can hover between worlds? We could make this work. I can go unconventional with you. And I saw once a documentary that was really condescending to her, where her character in a different film has to miscarry, and she's going to try to do this by falling down the stairs. And the critic said something like, she even understands this scene, what she has to do here. But she's not an idiot, obviously. You can tell by the way she acts. And I've wondered with this particular film, if the name Laura is a reference to, we've talked about lately how people don't die and they come back, whether you're on Game of Thrones or you're the Emperor from Return of the Jedi, whatever. Laura, the title character, appears to be dead, but she's not dead, and she's not the first or even most famous Laura to be dead and come back from the dead, because we have that in Wilkie Collins' The Woman in White, where in the middle of the book, spoiler alert for you people out there who haven't read it, we find out that this person, this love interest that we thought was dead, not in fact actually dead. And Vincent Price in this film is awesome. He is just starting out in his career, and he's this horny, nasty little lecher who's up to no good. He's not the urbane, right, come on, into my cave, Brady kids, type of guy that he'll be for a long time after this. He's sort of finding out who he's going to be, and he's a really effective character actor. He had great actorly chops, like legitimate type of chops, and this is one surprise after another. And we've talked about him before when we discussed the Oxbow incident, but I don't think Dana Andrews gets nearly enough credit as a player in mid-century cinema. He was one of the great American actors who could both carry a film, and I think to really carry a film well, you have to be like Andrews or Mitchum, where you double at the same time as a character actor, where you evince so much of your personality in that lead role, and he definitely does that.
And finally, want to talk about another great film with Colin Fleming from 1944, Bluebeard.
Bluebeard, if you've seen it, people, it is probably in a horrible, trashy print that looks like it has been stomped upon and rolled over and all of that, because it's been in the public domain for so long. It was a cheap jack film, and that's what the director, Edgar Ulmer, tended to make. Now, Ulmer was a teller of tall tales. He came from Germany, and he would have said to anybody, oh, yeah, Fritz Lang, M doesn't get made without me, Metropolis. I was there. I basically did all of it, and then he stole my credit at the end. So he comes to America, and he makes these Poverty Row cheapies. And this film had this very grim subject matter that Charlie Chaplin would basically rip off later. But Chaplin was such a ripoff artist, he also ripped it off from Orson Welles, where this guy is like the strangler of women. And the country, the people who loved it the most, it was a massive, massive hit in France. And it didn't do much box office over here, but it's one of those films that has basically become the foundation of Ulmer's legacy. Detour is another one. I recently wrote about that novel. It'll be out this coming weekend, where you had this director who could set up shots and execute compositions like a kind of junior Orson Welles, who had a budget that made Orson Welles, when he had no budget, look like the King of Camelot. And he made these grungy, low-rent, tawdry films that hold up really well right now. It's almost sometimes like someone has filmed a stage production with a kinescope, right? And you're watching it through the kinescope, and it somehow last. It endures because of this man's defiant artistic vision.
And John Carradine, who could choose scenery with anybody in the history of cinema.
Carradine, he was great during this period. Now, he is an absolute schlock. He is in Universal horror films, not like Bride of Frankenstein, not like the Prestige Universal horror films. He's in the Monster Rally film,
right.
House of Dracula, House of Frankenstein, where it's like, eh, I don't really know what we should do for a plot. Just round up everybody. Get the monster. Get the Wolfman. Can you, like, stuff Lon Chaney into a Dracula cape if he's not drinking? And Carradine was Dracula in those. But again, he was urbane. He was a great Dracula in just dreadful movies. But they work because of him. He has one of those faces and one of those modes of expression with his voice that you're pulled to him when he's on the stage. And when he's on screen. And I think that's part of where the scene eating comes from with him, where he thought, you know what? A little of this goes a super, super far away. So I'm going to do like a huge amount of it and go even further in this horrible picture I'm in, right? So he was someone you couldn't look away from. And he's just a great villain. Like, it would be difficult to imagine him as a good guy.
Right.
He just kind of has to be that terrible, terrible person that's going to die at some point in the picture, and you think, well, it's probably for the best that he's no longer with us.
Some great films from 75 years ago, worthy of a viewing if you haven't seen them before, or going back to revisit them again, as I do Double Indemnity and Gaslight at least once a year. Got to check those out again. By the way, check out all of Colin's work, the newly updated website, ColinFlemingLit.com. Lots of good stuff there. You're caught up on everything now, aren't you?
No, I'm not caught up. That's the sort of unpleasant, protracted work I've been doing today. So I have to do the music tab, but there's a film tab and the radio tab, and there's an op-ed tab and the literature tab. Those are all caught up going back 5 or 6 years, but there's just a gargantuan number of music things. There must be 75 that I have to pop up there pretty soon.
Well, you'll keep yourself busy with what's there now, so go visit ColinFlemingLit.com, and Colin will visit again next Tuesday afternoon.
Okay, sounds good, my friend. Keep your head up.
Yes, indeed. No, I don't. I can only blame myself if I don't follow that advice.